From WIPR, I'm Sheila Cast. We're on the record. Late last year, a census of Maryland's oyster population revealed an alarming decline. There are now about 300 million oysters, half the number of two decades ago. Tim Wheeler of the Bay Journal walks us through the causes for the decline, from disease and loss of habitat to harvest pressure.
The number of oysters that are taken out of the bay affects it because there are fewer to reproduce. And the mere fact of dredging a reef can spread and scatter those shells around and make it a little harder for the oysters to find.
Then, how do you raise oyster larvae? Stephanie Alexander of the Horn Point Oyster Hatchery takes us from spawning to spat on shell. It's on the record after the news.
You're listening to On the Record, the podcast, a service of your public radio, 88.1 WYPR. Find more podcasts online at wypr.org. And tell us what you think. Send an email to ontherecord@wypr.org.
Good morning, I'm Sheila Cast. We're on the record. Oysters were once so plentiful in the Chesapeake that their reefs posed navigational hazards for boats. Some scholars speculate that before colonial times, there were enough oysters to filter a volume of water equal to that of the Chesapeake in just a few days. In late November, headlines revealed the alarming conclusions of a new report, an assessment by the State Department of Natural Resources and the University of Maryland Center for Environmental Science, found that Maryland's oyster population had fallen to half what it had been in 1999. The state has been working to protect and replenish the oyster population for years. Nearly 9,000 acres of the bay and tributaries are part of an oyster sanctuary network. Here to update us on the Bay's oyster population is Timothy Wheeler, associate editor and senior writer for the Bay Journal. He's covered the Chesapeake Bay and other environmental issues for three decades. Welcome back to the show.
Glad to be here, Sheila.
The assessment I mentioned, how was it conducted?
Well, it's a stock assessment. It's the first time that Maryland has done one of those in all its history. It was an attempt to sort of, you know, bring all the science to bear on what we know about how many oysters there are in the Maryland portion of the bay. And they looked at all the data that had been collected for various reasons, harvest figures. The Department of Natural Resources does a variety of surveys. One of the most long-lasting ones is an annual fall survey of oyster reefs to determine how many oysters are there, how many young oysters, and how many have died in the previous year, and how much disease there is. They fed all this into some mathematical modeling. The problem with, you know, trying to take a census of any wild creatures, it doesn't stand still to be counted. Oysters do stand still, but they're at the bottom of the bay.
They're pretty stationary.
yeah, but they're at the bottom of the bay. It's a little hard to count them all. So these are estimates, but this is the best scientific estimate that we've had of how many oysters there are and what's been happening to them.
Well, in 1999, the oyster population was estimated at 600 million oysters. What has been the pace of decline since then?
Yeah. Now, that should be qualified as market-sized or adult, whatever you want to call it, market-sized oysters. The juveniles could have been many more. But, of course, before they get to market size, a lot of them die or eaten or die from disease. So what's happened is that there have been outbreaks of disease. There are a pair of diseases called Dermo and MSX. And so there was a bad outbreak between 99 and the current days. It happened in the early 2000s. And the population fell, the adult population fell from 600 million to about 200 million, according to their estimates at that time.
And that was 2002,
around 2002, 2004, in that time frame. Our commercial harvest sort of fell comparably. It was hit an all-time low of about 19,000 bushels in 2004. So that was sort of the low point. Things bounced back some from them, but then again, they have begun to slide again lately in recent years.
What caused the decline?
You know, disease played a big role. Habitat loss played another big role. Oysters create their own habitat. Their shells are what they, you know, what the young oysters settle on to grow and survive. And so as they are buried under sediment and silt in the bay, they're lost. And harvest pressure played a role too. the number of oysters that are taken out of the bay affects it because there are fewer to reproduce. And the mere fact of, you know, dredging a reef can spread and scatter those shells around and make it a little harder for the oysters to find them.
What areas have the most fragile oyster populations?
The study sort of carved up the Maryland portion of the bay into 36 different zones and looked at each of them, and they found roughly about half, 19 out of the 36, had harvest pressures that were, current harvest pressures that were exceeding what they considered to be a sustainable level based on the number of oysters, the abundance of oysters there, and also based on reproduction, evidence of reproduction. And you found some problems in Eastern Bay, in the Western Shore in particular, the Western Shore rivers, and the Potomac River too, were problematic. There were some bright spots around the Chop Tank and the Lower Bay, but a good half of the bay was in sort of a delicate situation. What they warned was that if those kinds of rates continued, you could expect to see the population decline.
And so is it fair to say that the other half of the zones, the oyster population was secure, that harvesting was not a risk?
On paper, it would look that way, yeah. I mean, one of the things that's a little bit of a complication is that they did count the oysters in the sanctuaries and their abundance figures for that zone. And so, you know, those oysters under the current regime are not harvestable. That doesn't mean that if you took them out of the equation that would make the picture necessarily a lot worse. I mean, I actually asked the scientists about that. They said that it's the other variable here is reproduction. And so even if you've taken a significant share of the oysters out of the area, if there are enough left to reproduce and to replace the ones that are taken, then things are okay. And it's harder to judge that. They said they really couldn't break down the reproduction figures enough to really sort of gauge the impact that taking the sanctuary oysters out of the equation would mean for the harvest.
That's Tim Wheeler, associate editor and senior writer for the Bay Journal, here on The Record on WIPR. I'm Sheila Cast. We're talking about Maryland's precarious oyster population. Right before that assessment came out, another study concluded that warmer water temperatures were to blame rather than overfishing. Tell us about that study.
Well, this was a study done by a NOAA scientist and a federal scientist and co-authored with somebody from the Maryland Department of Natural Resources who contributed some data on the bay. It looked at different shellfish. Besides oysters, it also looked at clams and scallops, and it looked at them all up and down the East Coast. And they found some evidence, an association, if you will, between changes in water temperature, a current pattern called the North Atlantic Oscillation, and that when this tipped a certain way for a prolonged period of time, it seemed to have an impact on, there was also a sort of a decline in abundance of these shellfish. They went on to say in there that they did not believe over-harvesting had been really a factor in those declines. I talked to a few scientists who have focused on the Chesapeake Bay, and they thought that maybe could not necessarily be applied in the bay, that there was ample evidence that harvest pressure and habitat degradation did play a role in the loss of oysters in the Chesapeake, at least.
This North Atlantic Oscillation... Mm-hmm. This is not climate change.
Not necessarily, no. They were looking at 20, 30-year trends in this. I mean, the weather varies from year to year, but it sort of tips one way or another sometimes. We see prolonged periods of heavy rainfall like we've had lately. Whether that's climate change or not, we won't know for another 30 years or more. So they weren't calling this specifically climate change. They were saying it was a change in the pattern, because they said that the pattern had shifted back about 15 years ago, about the time that we saw the oyster population in the bay start to recover. But things have not necessarily stayed that way. We're seeing the oyster population in the bay slip again.
So oscillation doesn't mean it's a current or a trend like El Nino. It's an oscillation in statistics, not a movement in the water currents.
Well, it really is a movement in the winds and the water. Yeah. So it those things vary. from year to year, and they're influenced by a number of factors.
Maryland and Virginia have pledged to undertake restoration efforts in five of their tributaries by 2025. How far along is Maryland in that?
Maryland has finished one of its five tributaries, Harris Creek, and that means that they have finished putting in all the reefs. They have continued to go back and reseed some thin spots in the oysters, but they have basically declared that one completed. They're still working on two others, Little Chop Tank and the Tred Avon. All of these are on the eastern shore. And the Little Chop Tank is pretty far along. The Tred Avon is also mostly done, but there's a hang-up with that one. That one is primarily federally funded, whereas the Chop Tank is state-funded. And the federal funds for the Tred Avon have run out, so it's sort of hanging fire. The state has two other tributaries to complete its obligation for five that it has identified, the St. Mary's River in southern Maryland and the Minocan River on the lower eastern shore. Those have not been officially designated, but that's pending.
And is it thought that they would be funded with state money, or is that also a federal project?
The Department of Natural Resources has said that they want to do those totally with state money without using any federal money. And there's some question about where that money's going to come from, because it could be quite expensive. But that preserves the state's option if they would like to open those sanctuaries later for harvest, which has been a sort of a bone of contention. If federal money is used, the federal government will not allow harvest to take place there because they only give money for restoration, not for commercial ventures.
And so is there any talk about moving the Tred Avon into state funding? Or is it just a matter of waiting and hoping that federal funding comes through?
That's a good question. I mean, the state could theoretically pony up some of its own money to finish the job. The last 40 acres of reef restoration were estimated by the Corps to cost somewhere between $3 and $5 million. It would not be cheap, but if the state is also looking at spending its own money to do the St. Mary's and the Minocan, they may feel that they want the federal government to finish what it set out to do.
Last year, a measure became a state law without Governor Hogan's signature that barred harvesting within protected oyster bars until this oyster survey was completed. Is this something we can expect now to be reassessed?
I'm pretty sure we're going to hear about that. I wouldn't be at all surprised if there's a move made to open some of the sanctuaries. The Department of Natural Resources was headed in that direction when the legislature passed that law. I fully imagine that the watermen and the department are going to press to open some of the sanctuaries, not the ones that federal money has been spent on, because that's a sort of a legal and a political issue to try to change that. But I can imagine that will happen. I'm pretty certain that some of the environmental groups are going to try to at least codify or protect the restoration tributaries from that kind of change in status.
Would it take action by the General Assembly?
I think they're going to ask the General Assembly to put them in the law that they are identified as sanctuaries.
Taking matters into their own hands are entrepreneurs who have started private oyster hatcheries, but that has met with local opposition. Tell us about complaints in St. Mary's County.
Well, St. Mary's County has seen a lot of aquaculture activity. Maryland's aquaculture industry pretty much died out during the disease outbreaks that we talked about before. But it started to come back and come back strongly. And there's been pushback in St. Mary's County, primarily from waterfront property owners. So the county commissioners adopted a six-month moratorium on the use of commercial docks there to work any newly issued water column leases, those using the cages or the floats. The problem here from a legal standpoint is the state controls the water. The state issues the leases. The county has no power over that. They wanted the state to give them power. It's basically a matter of state law the way it is now.
So something we should watch in the legislature.
That probably will come up too.
The next issue of the Bay Journal comes out in early January. What
can we look forward to reading about?
Well, more about aquaculture conflicts. This is an issue that's growing and been continuing on both ends of the bay. Virginia has its own share of problems with this as well. And there may be, as we said, some legislation out of that, and maybe some changes in policy and regulation. Here in Maryland already, the Department of Natural Resources opted to essentially create a new sort of online database of all pending lease applications so that people can get a better and a sooner awareness of what's proposed in their part of the state.
Tim, thanks for walking us through it.
Sure.
Thank you.
My pleasure.
Timothy Wheeler is associate editor and senior writer for the Bay Journal. At the On the Record page at WIPR.org, you can find links to the Bay Journal's reporting on Maryland's oyster population. Quick break here on the record. When we're back, what does it take to grow oyster larvae? I'm Sheila Cass. Stay tuned.
This is the On the Record podcast, a service of Your Public Radio, member-supported 88.1 WYPR. You can support this podcast and everything you hear from WYPR. Become a member. Come to WYPR.org and click the donate link.
Welcome back to On the Record. I'm Sheila Cast. Pollution, overharvesting, disease, all of these factors pose a threat to the Bay's fragile oyster population. Late last year, a survey by the State Department of Natural Resources and the University of Maryland Center for Environmental Science estimated that Maryland's oyster population had shrunk from 600 million oysters in 1999 to about 300 million oysters today. For decades, researchers at the university's Horn Point Laboratory Oyster Hatchery in Cambridge have raised oyster larvae and studied oyster husbandry practices. As one of the largest oyster hatcheries on the East Coast, Horn Point produces larvae for research, restoration, and educational projects. With us to talk about restoring the Bay's oyster population is Stephanie Alexander, Senior Faculty Research Assistant and Oyster Hatchery Manager at Horn Point Laboratory. Welcome to the show, Stephanie.
Thank you.
Fertilized oyster eggs grow into larvae, which grow into spat. How many spat does Horn Point produce each year?
That varies with the year. In 2018, we produced about 1.7 billion oyster spat.
Billion.
Billion, yes. The year before that, we were about 1.8 billion. So every year is different. We have different water quality and different aspects, salinity, that we have to deal with. But our goal is to produce as many as we can every single year with the funding that we're given.
And a lot of those spat never become adults.
Correct. We produce the spat that we can. We put them overboard. There is going to be natural mortality. But everything is helping and boosting the oysters in the bay.
Give us an overview of the process of producing oysters.
So we go in the winter, like about now, we're getting ready to start up for the year. We collect adult broodstock, which are just oysters from the bay. We bring them into the hatchery, and we have a conditioning period. That conditioning period is about 2 to 3 months. We bring them into the hatchery, and we have a system where we can regulate the water temperature on the oysters. We can make it warmer and make the oysters think it's actually closer to the summer than it really is. And with them thinking it's closer to the summer, they're more likely to start putting on their reproductive organs. So if all goes well, we can typically start for the season in March or early April. Oysters in the bay will not start spawning until June at the earliest if it's a warm month.
So are you just moving the season earlier, or are you extending the season for oysters?
We are doing both. So we're moving up the season so we can start spawning earlier, but we're also extending it so we can spawn later into the season. And by being able to give us a bigger window of production, we can produce more oysters and therefore more spat on shell.
Well, so take a minute to tell us what spawning is.
Once we have the ripe oysters, we then move them to our second system, which is our spawning table. And this is where we make the oysters think it is summertime. They are going to start releasing their gametes. once they release their gametes, we can then tell if it's a male or a female.
So what do you see with the males and what do you see with the females?
So oysters are broadcast spawners. So when they start spawning, males release sperm from the side of their shells, and females will pulse their shells open and close every 30 seconds or so, and they will release like a puff or a cloud of oyster eggs. So depending on what their behavior is and what they're releasing, we can sex them.
And what do you do when you observe that?
So once we know who's who, we separate them into different containers, and we let them spawn together for about a half hour, 45 minutes. And during this time, they'll spawn to completion.
Let me make sure I understand. When you say let them spawn together, but you've separated the males and the females.
Correct. We separate them so we can control fertilization. Because the biggest problem in oyster hatcheries is if you over-fertilize the oyster eggs, then the embryos aren't going to develop. In the river, you have water currents constantly moving. So as the oysters are on the bottom of the river, they are spawning, eggs and sperm come in contact, and then the water currents move them away. So there is no fear of over-fertilization. But in the hatchery, we have to be able to separate them. So once we separate them and we have our males and our females, they still continue to release their gametes. It doesn't matter that they aren't next to each other anymore.
And so once they've worn themselves out, they've stopped, what happens?
Yes. We will take all of the eggs that we collected, we will sieve them, and we will do a count on them. So let's say we have a billion. That's a very common number. We will then fertilize them with the correct amount of sperm. We will observe them under the microscope to make sure they're undergoing their divisions. And once we determine that they're successfully fertilized, we will then put them into one of our big larval tanks, and we will start the grow-out process. Once they're in our larvae tanks, they're in there for about 2 to 3 weeks. And every day we feed them. During the week, we do water changes, and we maintain a very optimal environment for them to grow in.
And then?
And then, at the end of those 2 to 3 weeks, the larvae start maturing. And as they start maturing, they develop an eye spot and a foot. Once we have the mature larvae, we then take them down to our setting tank, where we introduce them into our outside tanks with shell. They will then encounter a shell they like, glue themselves to that shell, they undergo a metamorphose, and then that's when we call them spat.
This is On the Record on WIPR. I'm Sheila Cast, speaking with Stephanie Alexander, Oyster Hatchery Manager at the University of Maryland Center for Environmental Sciences' Horn Point Laboratory, one of the largest oyster hatcheries on the East Coast. So at Horn Point, larvae are poured on top of old oyster shells, which become their homes. In nature, if an oyster doesn't have an empty shell to attach to, do they grow their own shell?
They do grow their own shell, but they need to attach to a hard substrate to go on with the next phase of their life. So here at the hatchery, we introduce them into large tanks with old recycled shell in it. Oyster Recovery Partnership, one of our big partners in all of this, they have shell recycling alliances, and they also obtain shell and clean it. We put it in containers, and then it gets loaded into the tank. They will attach themselves to that shell. They glue themselves to it. It's a one-time, one-stop process. If they don't find something they like, they will end up dying.
As you mentioned, Horn Point Oyster Hatchery works with the Oyster Recovery Partnership and Maryland's Department of Natural Resources to sell oyster larvae, seeds, spat, and shells to public or private farms. Are all of these oysters destined to be eaten?
Not all of them. With our sanctuary program, a lot of those oysters will be going into closed areas where they are going to grow and mature and become the future parents of the bay. Some of our oysters do go to private watermen or farmers, and those oysters will go into the market for eating. But that's also taking the pressure off the wild oysters as well.
What can people who want to support the bay's oyster population do to get involved?
There's a variety of things. The first one is, if you do eat oysters, please recycle your oyster shells. Oyster Recovery Partnership has a shell recycling alliance where they work with many of the restaurants in Maryland, Virginia, D.C., Ocean City, where if you eat oysters, those shells come back, they get recycled, and then they go through the oyster hatchery process. So all the shells are just kind of going right back to where they came from. You can also participate in the Marylanders Grows Oysters program.
What's it called?
MGO program, Marylanders Grow Oysters. If you are a homeowner with waterfront property and you have a pier, you can get oysters and grow them. And after a year, you have to maintain them, take care of them. The state will come back and collect them, and those oysters go on a sanctuary. So they're really good for education. Because I'm growing oysters on my pier, I might convince my neighbors to do it. And the more people and the more oysters we can get overboard, the better off we're going to be.
Thank you so much for walking us through this. Thank you.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
Stephanie Alexander is Senior Faculty Research Assistant and Oyster Hatchery Manager at Horn Point Laboratory of the University of Maryland Center for Environmental Science. At the On the Record page at WYPR.org, we've got links to more information about Horn Point and the life cycle of oysters. This is On the Record. I'm Sheila Cass. Thanks for listening. Join us again tomorrow.
Thanks for listening to this segment of On the Record with Sheila Cast. You can catch the show on the radio Monday through Friday, 9:30 to 10 a.m. on 88.1 WYPR, your NPR news station. And you can support On the Record and all the other public radio programs that WYPR brings to you. Just click the donate link at the top of WYPR.org. And thanks.